The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Jason Freeman, author, events producer, and I am here to introduce Ian Baruma, and I'm very excited to do so. Praised as, I love this, a keen observer and the owner of a well-provisioned mind, and one of those rare historian humanists who bridge East and West, Ian Baruma is the author of Year Zero, The China Lover, Murder in Amsterdam, Occidentalism, God's Dust, Behind the Mask, The Wages of Guilt, Bad Elements, and Taming the Gods. He was last year for Their Promised Land, an account of his grandparents' love and separation during the 20th century's darkest hours. The winner of the penned Diamonstein Spielvogel Award, you also get an award for pronouncing that correctly, for the Art of the Essay, the Erasmus Prize, and the Shorenstein Journalism Award. He is the editor of that venerable and estimable journal, the New York Review of Books. Tonight, Mr. Baruma joins us with his latest book, a memoir titled A Tokyo Romance, A Vivid Journey into That City's Frenetic 70s Underground Culture, and its accompanying motley cast of artists, expatriates, and oddballs of every stripe. I loved the first line of the review of this book in this very day, today's New York Times. It says, Ian Baruma's A Tokyo Romance is a memoir of both his own callow youth and the sophisticated provincialism endemic to Japan in the 1970s. It is a triumphal narrative of how determination, charm, readiness, and linguistic fluency allowed the author to penetrate one of the world's most insular societies, beginning as an enthusiast for the country's avant-garde culture and ultimately becoming a part of that culture. Here to tell us more about it, ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Ian Baruma to the Free Library.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. I'll tell you about two things that concern this book. One is how I got interested in Japan in the first place, and then how I got to write this particular book. There were no profound reasons for my interest in East Asia, no family connections, nothing in my childhood, no youthful enthusiasms for woodblock prints or anything like that. I knew nothing about East Asia when I left high school and then went to London for a short while in 1970, except that Asia was sort of in the air. That was the time that people took Volkswagen buses to Kabul and lit joss sticks and listened to Ravi Shankar and that kind of thing. And I knew some Indians in London who used their sort of oriental mystique with great success with young women. So there was that. And then there was a trip to California in 1971, which I describe in the book, which was really my first exposure to people at least of Asian extraction. And I made two friends for life, although one died, unfortunately, one of the two brothers. And we did a very conventional, they were both filmmakers, they were both Japanese Americans. And we did a very conventional thing for the time in my generation. We went to Disneyland on acid. And as those things go, apart from seeing the Supremes go through a costume change every 2 minutes, at least in my memory, we talked about the meaning of life. And in their case, that meant a brotherly discussion about what it meant to be of Asian origin or Asian family origin. And one of the brothers, the elder one, wasn't interested in it at all. He made movies and was very much Californian. The other one was interested and kept on saying, but thousands of years of Asian culture, that it's in our veins and so on. No, said the other brother. This was not a conversation I could really be part of, but somehow something of that may have sown a little seed that came to fruition later when I had to decide what to study at university. And I tried various things without success. Then I thought, why not do something that was exotic but could be useful? And Sanskrit may have been exotic, but would not probably have been all that useful. And so I thought, well, why not Chinese? I quite like the food. But that was really as deep as it went. And so I studied Chinese. But this was the very early 70s, when China was still in the Cultural Revolution. And it was really, modern China was like studying an abstraction, the other side of the moon. You couldn't go there unless you were part of a group of sort of official friends of the Chinese people and so on, and I wasn't. The very few students who did Chinese at the time could be neatly divided in sort of romantic Maoists and scholars who wanted to spend the rest of their lives with Tang poetry and that kind of thing. And again, I didn't really fit in. And China seemed grim and uninviting. And then I saw in Paris, in London, in Amsterdam, and so on, Japanese movies. And I fell instantly in love with them, really. And I also saw modern Japanese theater. And what fascinated me about the movies and the theater that I saw was the combination of both being clearly from a culture that was completely unfamiliar to me, call it exotic, but also deeply human. You could recognize the sort of common humanity under this surface that looked so different and unfamiliar and strange and so on. It was that really that combination that I found deeply alluring. I was not particularly interested, unlike many people at that time, in the sort of spiritual quest and finding deep wisdom in China or Japan or Korea. It wasn't really that. It was actually the modernity of Japan that I found more appealing. And again, the fact that it was both modern and very sort of culturally strange and yet so recognizably human. And I think one of the reasons it was so human is that Japanese films in their heyday in the 50s and 60s and before that were extremely sort of emotionally realistic. Directors dealt, and there was clearly a tolerance or a thirst for this in the Japanese public. They did not shy away from the darkest impulses of humanity, which again were entirely recognizable to me, and therefore sort of strangely attractive and reassuring about our common humanity. The thing that made the greatest impression on me was the performance of a theater group called the Tenjo Sajiki, which literally means the gods, the sort of cheap seats, led by one of those figures that were very common at the time, not only in Japan, but in the United States and other parts of the world too, the sort of guru-like theater manager, director, writer, and so on, who gathered a sort of group around him. And in this case, his name was Terayama Shuji, and he was a poet, a filmmaker, an extraordinary man who attracted runaways and strain and misfits and so on around him, and in a sort of Andy Warhol-like way made them all into extras is probably not quite the word, but in actors in acting out his own sort of very idiosyncratic fantasies. And the play I saw was called Opium War, and it was the most extraordinary thing I'd ever seen. The story I couldn't really follow, but it was there were sort of walls filled with extraordinary images, and there were opium dens, and there was nudity, and there was somebody, I think, killing a chicken, and you were led from room to room, and it was a totally bizarre and totally arresting spectacle. And I thought, if this is what Tokyo is like, I want to follow the circus and get out of here, which is more or less what I did. And I got to know Terayama and some of his actors, and I ended up in 1975 in Tokyo as a film student. I'd applied for film school, for a Japanese government scholarship to go to film school, and in those days, maybe still, the Japanese government would hand out several scholarships per country. Since nobody had ever, I think, applied for a film school in Tokyo, I got it without any problem. And so there I was, a foreigner in Japan in the mid-70s, a gaijin, as foreigners are called, or a particular kind of foreigners, of which I was one. And the gaijin is a very specific category. It literally means outside person, foreigner. But actually it's ethnic. Black people are not called gaijin, they're called kokujin, black people, literally. Asians are not really called gaijin either. Gaijin means a white Westerner. And in that period, when there were not that many, in fact, very few white Westerners in Japan, that put you in a very odd category because, as the word implies, it did mean you would never belong. You would never be accepted as sort of part of Japanese society or anything like that. You were an ultimate outsider, ethnically, culturally, and otherwise. On the other hand, Japanese, for at least 100 years, had been looking up to the West to imitate its high culture, to learn from the West in order not to be colonized in the 19th century. And, of course, because of its wartime defeat, was occupied for a while by the U.S., at which time the image of the white man, often resented as much as it was envied and admired, was that of somebody who had more money, was bigger, was almost superior in every way. So even though as a gaijin you could be discriminated against on very rare occasions in a negative sense of not being allowed to come into some public place, very, very rare, usually you were discriminated in a positive sense. And one of the one aspect of that is that you were not really expected to conform to the rules and obligations of Japanese life. You were freed from them. I mean, you couldn't behave outrageously, but although some people even did that and got away with it. And especially to an older generation, this was immensely attractive. And my great mentor and one of the main characters in my account of my life in Japan at the time, Donald Ritchie, who was an American writer and film critic and went to Japan in the late, just after the war, first, I think, in the Merchant Marine and then as a journalist for the Stars and Stripes, was rather typical of a particular kind of gaijin in that he grew up in Lima, Ohio, as a gay man or young boy, a place and a time that was not particularly hospitable to living a gay life. And so men of his age who arrived in Japan where there was enormous tolerance of whatever they did, sexually and otherwise, this was, of course, an enormous liberation, which is why you had a generation of some of the greatest scholars of Japanese literature, many of whom came from a very similar background and stayed or fell in love with Japan for similar reasons. That was not really my position in Japan. I was not a sexual exile. I was from a very different generation. And also, I think I immersed myself in, or tried to, in Japanese life in a way that people of the older generation had done less of because they were even more privileged or treated in a more privileged manner than even I was. And you find this even in the linguistic skills between the several generation of gaijins that lived in Japan, in that people who got there in the 40s often, even if they spoke fluent Japanese, still spoke it with an enormously foreign accent. They were surrounded often by people who spoke English, and the incentive to go native, as it were not quite as strong as people who came later. And so later scholars like John Nathan, who wrote a very good book, a biography of Mishima Yukio, speaks Japanese almost like a Japanese, which was rare for people who were older. In any case, there I was, the privileged gaijin, and that also meant that because people like me were so rare, that is, young Westerners who are interested in film and theater and that kind of thing in Japan, all doors very quickly opened. It didn't take much knocking. So it was very easy for me, a snotty-nosed nobody who hadn't accomplished anything, had very little to offer, to meet some of the most extraordinary people in the Japanese film and theater world, including Kurosawa and other filmmakers. And one of the reasons was, and that doesn't necessarily go for Kurosawa, who of course was a world-famous man already, but one of the reasons was that even as I was curious about Japanese and what they were up to, it was also a time that many Japanese, who were quite well known in Japan, but began to sort of reach out to the outside world. And so they were curious to know me in the same way that I was, well, not in the same way, but just as I was curious to meet them. And it had nothing to do with my individual merit. It was purely because of the rarity of my position. And I did sort of want to go native. I did have the sort of desire and the illusion that I could in some kind of way belong, which in fact is very difficult, if not impossible, which does not mean you can't make very warm friendships. On an individual, personal level, it was very easy to make friends in Japan, but you could not be part of the sort of collective we, as it were, because by definition you were outside all that. But still, learning to speak Japanese, spending most of my time with Japanese, I didn't have that many foreign friends, you do end up sort of acting like a Japanese in your body language and so on. You start sort of like a chameleon. You start sort of soaking up a lot of your surroundings. And in some ways, this was congenial to me, partly because of my own personal background, in that I grew up in a culturally mixed family at a time when this was not as usual in Europe as it is today. My father was from a Dutch Protestant family, although he, like many sons of ministers, very quickly renounced his faith and became an atheist. So I grew up in Holland with a Dutch father and a British mother who herself came from an Anglo-German Jewish family. And so I grew up bilingually, going back and forth between different cultures. And one thing that does is that it gives you a very keen sense of acting, in a way. I mean, you're an observer of how other people behave in different cultural contexts and environments, and you sort of take on their colors depending on where you are. But it makes you a sort of natural observer and outsider, and sort of sensitive to cultural differences and everything that involves. And so I found it quite congenial to go native in Japan and add yet another sort of act, if you like. And of course, all young men act anyway in order to sort of find out who they are, ultimately. So the amount of acting going on in my life at the time was considerable. I also met many people in the theater. Through Kurosawa, one of the first acts I participated in was actually in a whiskey commercial with Kurosawa. And then there was a second whiskey, which was very difficult because he was not a man for small talk. And so the director kept on saying, talk, talk, but he wouldn't really talk. But and the second whiskey commercial this again gives you a sort of flavor of what it is to be an outsider in Japan. It was for Suntory whiskey, so a Japanese brand, but the scene of the commercial was set in a sort of foreign bar, frequented by lots of foreigners drinking in a sort of animated fashion. And they'd rounded up a lot of the local GIs from one of the US military bases, many of them black. And so there we were, with glasses of whiskey. In my memory, it was tea, but a friend of mine I spoke to who was there with me recently told me actually it wasn't tea, it was whiskey, and it wasn't even Suntory whiskey, it was Johnny Walker Black Label, which was very peculiar. Anyway, there we were, drinking, trying to be animated and looking like people, like barflies. And the director suddenly said, cut, cut, cut. He said, no, I want it to be much more, much livelier. So we thought, okay, so we drank and we got livelier and the black guys got livelier and so on. And he said, cut, cut, cut. And in great exasperation, he came up to the stage and said to the black guys, you have to be more like black. And so the GIs then went, okay, here we go again. And they started high-fiving and so on. And they didn't mind. But it's something that only in Japan, and perhaps only in Japan in the 70s, although I don't think so, people would have got away with without even thinking there was something stereotypical and peculiar about their behavior. But I wasn't only doing whiskey commercials. I also got involved in the buto world, which is a very modern form, a deliberately grotesque form of dance, which has a lot to do with death and contortions and sort of torturous movements and that kind of thing. And I got involved with a theater director called Karajuro, who was the leader of a troupe called the Jokyo Gekijo, the Situation Theater. And what they did is they went around Japan in a red tent where they'd perform very odd plays, although not so odd in the context of the time and place. They were sort of a mixture of slapstick, bits of scandals from the newspapers, movie scenes mixed up with sort of Japanese and Western myths and that kind of thing. And it was sort of like Grand Guignol. It was grotesque, it was violent, it was raucous, and it was funny, and so on. And in many ways, what it represented was something that was very common in Japanese art at the time, and indeed in the arts in many countries, in a period of great experimentation, when politically and sexually and otherwise, of pushing the envelope, of breaking taboos and all that. And what Kara was trying to do was not to mimic, he was trying to find his way back to some kind of Japanese theater, but not by mimicking kabuki or no, anything like that, which had become a kind of fossilized museum-like, fascinating, but not something that was changing much at all anymore. So he didn't want to go back to that. But what he really wanted is to go back to the original spirit of kabuki. Kabuki began in the 17th century with outcasts and prostitutes performing very wild plays, which had very little to do with what it ended up being, the sort of high culture that it is today. And he wanted to really revive the sort of wildness of that original spirit in a completely contemporary form. And this was really not so much a reaction against the West itself, although attitudes towards the West were certainly complicated among people of Kara's generation, people who were born or grown up during the war and remembered the occupation. There was a lot of sort of love-hate for the West. But it wasn't a reaction or a rebellion against the West. It was a rebellion against Japanese attempts, which had been mainstream really for a long time, to mimic the high culture of the West, which had become stuffy and boring to them. So they went they really went back to this, well, not back, but they invented this sort of wild, almost primitive form of Japanese-ness in their theater and in their art. And one day, I loved being part of this group. I liked Kara. Kara was what the Japanese would call wet. And there's a distinction in Japan between dry and wet. Dry is sort of individualistic, detached, rather autonomous, and so on, in your human relations, which in Japan would be associated with the American way of life. Wet is sticky, full of obligations, people operating collectively rather than on their own, and so on. Kara was, myself, because of who I am, my temperament, and so on, I'm much more comfortable probably being dry, but the wetness of Kara's group, which was almost like a gang or a commune, was very attractive to me and was really the ultimate challenge of my going native and wanting to belong to some kind of Japanese scene. And so he cast me in one of his plays as a kind of friendly gesture. And it was an absurdistic play, all about people chasing somebody who had a placenta of babies who'd been switched around in a hospital, and then there was a drag queen who suddenly got transformed into a Japanese soldier who'd stayed behind in the jungle in Malaya until he was found in 1972, and everything was mixed up. So the fact that he cast me as Ivan the Terrible, who pretended to be the Midnight Cowboy, was by no means an unusual request. It sort of fitted very much into his world, and the Midnight Cowboy was a reference to the fact that my uncle, to whom I was very close, was a movie director called John Schlesinger, who made Midnight Cowboy. And so there I was, going with this group, and we went on tour with the Red Tent all over Japan, and it was never an entirely comfortable situation for me because I sort of belonged, but I didn't belong. I was in a privileged position that when we went out in the evenings, and I would be sitting next to Kara, the great man. On the other hand, I only played a very minor role, and I hadn't achieved anything much in life except for being a foreigner. And in a way, I was like a mascot. And when people came to visit us, the first remark was to Kara would always be, my, we've become international, I see, and that kind of thing. So maybe that had something to do with what later happened. Kara's wife, a Korean Japanese, who's had a Korean stage name, which was Ri Daesen, Ri, was a very fiery woman, and they would have enormous rows, a bit like Stanley Kowalski and Stella in Streetcar Named Desire, which, I mean, spectacular rows. And people would always say, oh, well, that's her Korean temperament, and they'll never split up because they need each other too much and all that. And there was a tension in the group because Ri, and as well as one of the main actors in the group, had started performing on television, which Kara saw as a kind of betrayal, and I think he was also a little envious. And the last night in Kyoto, after the performance, there was going to be a party, and we were visited by a minor gangster movie star. The sort of type who was always in gangster movies, picked more for the weirdness of his face, and he would usually die very early on in the story in spectacular fashion. And his name was Kawatani Takuzo, and he was playing in that same television series that Ri Daesen was in. And Ri was off to some other engagement that evening when we had our sort of post-rap party in a Japanese restaurant in Kyoto. And I will read to you what happened. I wasn't paying much attention to Kawatani. This is when we were sitting in the restaurant, Kawatani being the Yakuza star, who was sitting next to Kara. I was at the other end of a long table. It is possible that Kawatani had already had a few drinks before we arrived at the restaurant, but he didn't look particularly the worse for wear. But soon I sensed the beginning of an altercation with Kara. I wasn't close enough to see what started it. Later, I was told that Kawatani had been needling Kara in a particularly sore spot. The theater was old hat, he supposedly claimed. Kara was wasting his time. He should be doing more television or movies like Ri. And so, apparently, it went on for a while until Kara suddenly made his move. He lurched towards his guest. The gangster actor's face was drenched in beer, and Kara started furiously pummeling him with his fists. This was a sign for others to join the fray. For a short while, Kawatani was buried under a group of actors, showing their solidarity by furiously pounding the small writhing figure on the tatami, lightly sprinkled by splashes of blood. Once he emerged from the scrum, it was clear that Kawatani's face was a mess. A phone call was quickly made, and he was removed from the premises on a stretcher. I was speechless, as usual in scenes of actual violence. More than anything, it was the mob behavior of my fellow actors that shook me. Once again, I felt I was out of step with the group. I can't remember what was said after the fight. The evening is blank until an hour or so later, when Ri finally turned up. She had heard what had happened and was in a howling rage. Standing in the middle of the room, she wagged her finger at Kara, who was still sitting on the floor, and started screaming at him. What did he think he was doing? How dare he attack her friend and colleague in this manner? Who did he think he was? Kara's face went a darker red. He cursed his wife, grabbed a heavy ashtray like a glass brick, and flung it at her. Missing her head by inches, the ashtray shattered the wall covered in elegant rice paper paneling. I was so stunned that I didn't really know what I was doing. But I remember getting to my feet and blurting out to Kara something absurd, like, "You can't do that to a woman." There was a moment of baffled silence around the room. Kara could not believe what he was hearing. His furious eyes swiveled in my direction. His voice dropped to a menacing growl like a dangerous animal under threat. "How dare you speak to me like that?" I still don't know why I did it. What possessed me to humiliate Kara in this way in front of his actors? I should have known better than to interfere in a fight between husband and wife. What was behind this pompous gesture of chivalry? Could it have had something to do with my shaky sense of self in the midst of a Japanese theater group? Was it a displaced cry to be seen for who I rarely was? Did I even know myself? But I shall never forget Kara's words, repeated in unabated anger in the bus on our way back to the dormitory. "So you're just an ordinary gaijin after all." He was right. Of course I was. I realized that there were limits to what one can do to sort of fit in, go native, whatever you call it. Some foreigners who come to this conclusion then become rather resentful and bitter and take it out on the Japanese as though it's their fault, which it isn't, of course. Some foreigners get something called the gaijinitis, and they become oversensitive to any sign that they're not accepted or treated differently or anything of that sort. That didn't happen to me. I left because I didn't want to become a bore and just spend the rest of my life explaining Japan to the rest of the world. But I wasn't resentful. And I didn't really lose myself either in Japan. I think by doing what I did and sort of trying to fit into a completely Japanese environment, in some ways I understood myself better as a result. Now, briefly, to conclude how I wrote this book, I knew I wanted to write about these extraordinary years in my life for many years. I had the plans to do this, and I never knew how to do it. I considered fiction, which didn't work. I had various false starts, and I never really knew it. And then suddenly it hit me in the way that I think probably is true of most writers when they get an idea. It's not as a result of sort of long thinking. It's just it comes to you. And I realized that the only way I could write about myself was to do it through others and to write the story around the two characters who meant most to me in those years. And one was Donald Ritchie and the other one was Kara. The form was not entirely easy because I never kept a diary. I never wrote long letters. So it all had to come out of my head. I mean, the shreds of memory that get lodged in your mind and then edited and re-edited probably subsequently. So it's a bit like writing a novel because you have to make a coherent story out of disparate memories. And I hope the story is a good one. And with that, I'll open the floor to questions from you. Thank you very much. So I think I've been told to ask you to raise your hand, yes, and then a microphone will be on its way.
Thank you for sharing your memories. Assuming that you have continued to go back to Japan over the years and taking the last time you were there, what seemed to have been preserved, and in what way were there changes that came to your attention?
Well, that's a very good question. It's changed a great deal. When I was the 70s, like everywhere else, were the sort of, in some ways, the continuation of the 60s. And it's still, Japan had rough edges. There was an underground scene. It was exciting and to some extent even quite political still. And later, because of the bubble economy, because it became so rich, so fast, and then of course stagnated somewhat. It's become much, much smoother and slicker and on the surface more sophisticated. And some of the things that appealed most to me, the rebelliousness, the raffishness that was still, there were many pockets of that, have somewhat disappeared, I think. So I still find it immensely pleasant to be there, and I like the aesthetics and the food and the people, but I don't find that it holds the same excitement for me that it did then. But maybe if I go there now, age 21, I'd have a very different view.
I have a sense from your discussion let me ask you, do you think it's more difficult in Japanese society than in other Asian cultures to go native and become a part of who they are? Do you see that as a Japanese characteristic? I know you don't know all about the other cultures.
No, I don't think so. Certainly not in East Asia. I mean, it's a very easy place to make friends. That was never the problem. And I think that kind of racial nationalism, to call it that, is probably even more pronounced in Korea, both in the North and the South in different ways. China is slightly different. I mean, not that you'll be so easily accepted as Chinese, but it's a big continental culture, and they have rather different attitudes. So I think China and Japan are insular in that way, but certainly not impenetrable. Insular may not also be quite the right word. I mean, one of the reasons I was attracted to Japan, perhaps more than to China, apart from the Maoist period and all that, was that I find peripheral cultures interesting. I like cities that pretend to be something they're not. So I like Berlin, which wanted to be Vienna or Paris or London, and I like Shanghai for the same reason, because of the acting, but because a peripheral culture always feels the need to catch up and know what goes on in the center, which makes it very vibrant and full of energy. Whereas if you're in the center, whether it's in New York or in ancient China, and you feel that you're in the middle of things, you expect people to come to you. You don't have to bother finding out what goes on elsewhere. Or, I say New York, but I mean, one of the reasons I found America interesting, even when I was very young, was precisely that I think some part of the energy of America had something to do with that sort of, which is much less now, I think, than it used to be, but that sort of idea that somehow superior culture was in Europe or at least somewhere else. And I find that much more interesting than the cultures that feel that they're in the middle of the world.
I had really, no idea who you were 24 hours ago, but then I read The Inquirer, and I was,
Hooray for newspapers.
Yeah. But, your story really resonated with me. So I guess from what you were saying in the newspaper and this talk, you're talking a lot about, I guess, for example, in this talk, how the gaiji might get resentful that they can't become part of the Japanese society. And then I guess conversely with what you were talking about in the newspaper about, this, suicidal state of how you, like what you said of like America or Britain or whatever, I guess maybe you're talking about the sort of exclusion or culture insecurity, I guess. But I guess in the sense that if the Japanese culture is very strict and kind of forbidden for outsiders to become a part of, while the, I guess, American identity can almost be attained by anybody who comes
right
and becomes that American dream, do you think that maybe, conversely, like an American who was born in America and it just has that identity of America might be more resentful because someone can come and attain that same identity of them, and I guess maybe contributes to this whole suicidal state you see the country?
Well, that's a very difficult question. Also, even the tolerance towards assimilation or the welcoming attitude to people who want to assimilate has its limits in America. After all, in the early 1940s, Japanese Americans were suddenly not treated as Americans anymore. We know that there are growing problems now with Muslim American Muslims too. So there are limits to that. Even though there is a lot of the right-wing populist politics are exploiting fears of immigrants and outsiders in not only in Britain and America but everywhere in the Western world now, that is true, and there is less of that kind of resentment in Japan, but that's because Japan hardly has any immigrants at all. And the number of refugees that have been allowed to stay in Japan, you can count them on two hands over the last few years, probably. There are large numbers of Chinese, and that's one of the differences. I mean, to come back to the earlier question of what's changed, that is an enormous change. I mean, the presence of China, not just as a power that's going to be vastly greater than Japan in the not-too-distant future, the presence of Chinese, in young Chinese, especially in Japan, is also very marked. But I don't know. Germany, which was, after all, not traditionally all that hospitable to foreigners coming in, there are a lot of problems there now, political problems, because people feel that Angela Merkel let too many people in. The other thing, and then I'll wrap up my long-winded answer to your question, which doesn't really wrap anything up. I'll leave it at that.
Are you familiar with T.R. Reid and his experiences in Japan? He's been a journalist his entire life, and he was worked for the Washington Post. And he moved to Japan with his family in the 80s and lived there, and his daughters went to school there and fit right in. He doesn't really comment on so much on feeling alienated. He's I think a fairly conventional guy in so many ways, but he seemed to adapt quite readily, and he embraced so much of Japanese cultures and the values, and the name of his book is Confucius Lives Next Door, and Confucian culture and values that permeates East Asian culture. And so he has very positive things to say about Japan.
Yeah, and, no, I have positive things to say,
Japanese culture.
Yes, I am aware of his work. Of course, I'm sure he did. His children no doubt went to Japanese schools, and I'm sure he did adapt to many aspects of Japanese life. But he was a correspondent for an American newspaper living with an American family. That already... Well, yes, but... That's already a very different situation from being on your own with surrounded by nothing but Japanese. And my girlfriend was Japanese. I mean, I think being there with somebody of your own, living with as it were your own people, already makes a fundamental difference. So the most personal side of your life is an island in the midst of this other culture. So, which is not to disparage him in the slightest, but I do think it's a somewhat different situation. And not only was he correspondent for the Washington Post, but the person for a while who set up most of his appointments in Japan was my present wife.
Going as just as someone unfamiliar with the culture and not the language, and the language not familiar with that, how did you deal with a linguistic challenge?
Well, I had basic Japanese, because in those days, if you studied sinology, you had to do basic Japanese. And also, my girlfriend was Japanese, so I spoke it with her. She taught me a lot. And I traveled around before I was a film student for 3 months in Japan with somebody who didn't speak any English. And at that age, you're like a sponge. And so I did have basic Japanese. And so it wasn't as though I needed an interpreter. One aspect of the linguistic problem is that Japanese, much more than modern Chinese, is very much a language of etiquette. And it depends on your gender, your age, your social status, and so on. The language you use depends on that. And even the verb endings, everything depends on that. And that means if you speak very rudimentary Japanese, you can make any mistake in the book and people won't mind. If you speak it relatively fluently and you start making those kind of mistakes, talking to somebody who's older than you and perhaps, you know, has a higher social status, and you talk to them as though they're your pal, people will be less forgiving because that would really grate. So the better you learn to speak, the harder it gets in some ways.
Does Japan, modern Japan, suffer any of the sort of right-wing, left-wing, rural, city, left-behind people that Europe and the United States are now suffering, mainly because of economic, modern economy?
That's a very complicated issue. The short answer is yes. But it's a different situation from here in Europe. In Europe and also here, even though that kind of politics and that kind of politician is now occupying the White House, but it is a movement, it's with the Tea Party and so on, or the right-wing parties in Europe, that have positioned themselves as rebels, as outsiders who are going to upset the establishment. And in America, they've done so successfully. In Japan, in some ways, the heart of the establishment itself has a lot of those attitudes in politics. So Abe, Prime Minister Abe, who's a child of enormous privilege, I mean, his grandfather was a cabinet minister during the war, and in fact, a war criminal, and his father was a foreign minister, and so he couldn't be more establishment, but he has a lot of the attitudes and the rural votes that back those kind of attitudes the populists. So, for example, one of the most shameless things in one of his recent meetings with Donald Trump was when he said to Donald Trump, "We've tamed the Asahi newspaper, which is the sort of main liberal newspaper in Japan. I hope you can do the same to the New York Times." And that is, he's a nationalist, he hates sort of the liberal academe, liberal newspaper, liberal media, and so on. So a lot of those attitudes are right there in the middle. And like everywhere else in the world, in the Western world, the left, which was never really in power in Japan, but they had quite a lot of influence in the post-war years, especially in universities, intellectual life, the magazines and that kind of thing, have lost their voice. And so the right almost dominate the scene in the same way that is happening elsewhere.
I was fascinated by your story. Thank you, very, very engaging. You make me think a lot about modern identity. I've been reading a book called Reformations, in which identity is so religiously based, you know, in the 16th century and so forth. And you made me wonder where people are going to find their identity in the future. Is it going to be the language? Is it going to be the mix of languages or cultures that they happen to find in their family? What happens to people as they become more international? I just would love to hear your reflections on the sources of identity at this time in our life.
Right. Well, but what you're describing is probably for many people was always true. It was never one thing. It's a mixture. It could be of religion, language, culture, shared habits, traditions. And clearly, not every country is the same. One reason why the United States is teeming with lawyers, and in Japan there are too few, is that a country of immigrants has to rely on the law and on lawyers to sort of keep things together, because it can't rely on shared ancestry or tradition, because people come from so many different traditions and cultures. Whereas in Japan, there's a strong tendency to rely on the way things were always done, rather than go to the law to redress any problem. And that is not altogether a good thing, because when you rely too much on the way things were always done, those who benefit from the ways things were always done tend to stay on top. But it's only very recently, really, that, for example, women, and there are not that many yet, but there, it's a growing number, in Japan are actually now trying to find recourse, sometimes through lawyers, to deal with bullies at work and that kind of thing, sexual harassment. But it's rare, because there was a stigma attached to that. You're a troublemaker. If in a society where people depend very much on custom and tradition, those who protest are sort of rocking the boat, being difficult. And that's used politically. I mean, in China, for example, anybody who opposes the monopoly of the Communist Party on power is very quickly branded un-Chinese or anti-Chinese. So that's one answer to your question. The other answer is, I don't know. Because societies change. I'm not so sure. We're becoming more international, and in some ways, again, to come back to the question, earlier question of how much, what has changed, one thing that's changed very much is that in the 70s, young Japanese in particular were really interested in going out to the outside world and traveling on with backpacks and studying foreign languages. And that's changed enormously. People are much more inward-looking, less interested in foreign countries, less interested in going abroad. And I think the Japanese are not alone in that way. So in some ways, I think in many countries, people have become more inward-looking again, less international. I would not be surprised if there were fewer volunteers of the Peace Corps now in the U.S. than there were in the 60s.
I wanted to know how you made the shift from theater to books.
Well, I was never a great actor, so I didn't have any serious ambition to be an actor. I did have dreams of making films, and I was a photographer, but so I was much more visual than I am now. Not than I am now, but then I thought that would be what I was going to do. But to make money, I wrote film reviews for the local English language paper, which was the Japan Times. And I sort of discovered I was not bad at it, and I found it quite congenial to write. I was never a writer. I was not one of those high school kids who wrote for the high school magazine or anything like that. And then for a while I did photography as well as write my own stories, and then I found that became very difficult because it's a different way of approaching a story and looking at a story. And so I decided I was best suited to express my opinions on my own through writing, and the rest fell by the wayside.
You spoke to this a little bit, but I was just wondering how your time in Japan kind of shaped your identity since you were so young when you were there.
How it shaped my identity? Well, that's very hard to say, because then you have to sort of psychoanalyze yourself, which I can't do. Also, it's very hard to know whether... there are certain aspects of Japanese society I find very congenial and I feel comfortable with. For example, avoiding conflict. I like that through sort of politeness and so on. But it's not so much that I was this wild conflict seeker who went to Japan and suddenly saw the light and learned from the Japanese and came back being averse to conflict. I was probably already like that. And so, and that's probably why I chose the place. It clearly has left its mark. I'm married to a Japanese. I speak it every day. Does that make me a Japanese? No. But like every other experience, in the end, that's what you are. You're a collection of your experiences, and all of them shape you in one way or another. But again, I think it would need a shrink to try and sort out exactly what is what.
If I'm not mistaken, you grew up in the Netherlands?
Yes.
Getting back to your point about like living in somewhat marginal societies, do you see any similarities there between Dutch culture and Japanese culture, say in contrast to say British or American?
Yes, in the sense that I'll give you a good example. It's easier to find the New York Review of Books, which I edit, in a train station in The Hague than it is to find anywhere in New York City. I think that probably answers your question. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.